The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today David Lee Garrison. He joins us on the telephone in Kansas. Hello, David.
Hi, glad to be here.
David, I see you've got a new book of poetry out, and I think many of our listeners are aware of you and of your work. But for those who are not, please tell us about your poetry, about your poetic career, and also your connection with WYSO and poetry.
All right. Well, I started writing poetry in high school. I think many people are like that because it was a way of dealing with adolescent angst and, expressing myself then. And I kept on going, and I just found that poetry was what interested me the most. And then I began publishing in my 20s and 30s and have not stopped there. And my last book was a book of poems about high school. It's called Carpeing the Diem, all poems about high school. And this one, it's called Light in the River, is, I guess you could say, it's mostly about aging and reflections on the past.
And you've been involved with poetry here on WYSO for a number of years.
Yes.
And going back
Absolutely.
To your collaboration with the legendary Conrad Balliet.
We read poems by Shakespeare and Robert Burns and modern poets and a lot of local poets. About half of the poets that we read on Conrad's Corner are local poets. A lot of poems deal with seasons, so I'll write I'll find a poem that's about the fall, for example, in September and October. Sometimes it's just who haven't I read for a while of the poets that I like from the past and from local poets. Conrad kept a very detailed list of the people that he had read and tried to kind of vary things so that he wasn't always reading the same people.
Let's talk about this collection, Light in the River. How do you decide what goes into this collection? What's the process? How old are some of these poems? How do you put it together? I know there's a strategy there.
Putting a book together is difficult. I often choose some poems that are old, some that are new, and I try to see how they coalesce, how they come together.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most difficult decisions is what poems you put up front in the beginning. And I went round and round about that and finally chose some poems that were kind of quirky, humorous. I didn't want to start with the more serious poems, and I didn't want to start with rhyming poems. That was a decision I went round and around on, but I finally came down on beginning with these kind of quirky, humorous poems. A lot of my poems are meant to be funny. People tend to think of poetry as something deadly serious and contrived, and I don't see it that way. I feel like poetry is communication. And if I write a poem and nobody understands what it's about, I feel like I've failed with that poem anyway.
Uh-huh.
And I also feel like humor is something that belongs in poetry. Billy Collins is a guy who has done a lot to further the cause of accessible poetry and funny poetry. I don't know if you've ever heard him read, but he's absolutely a stitch.
I've had him on the program.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I heard your interview with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's great. And you have a lot of these funny poems in the section called And Dog Said.
Yes.
And I'll admit, I did laugh. When you get to the end of a poem like Meatballs, if you don't laugh, you weren't paying attention. And one, I turned the page, and I actually was – I almost fainted when I saw the title of one of your poems, because I'm a person who wants to feel a personal connection with poetry. Like when you write a poem about getting older, I feel that connection. Sometimes I'll read a poem, and I'll just say, you know, not your poetry particularly, but someone's. I'll read it and I'll go, I don't get it. You know, I don't relate to that. Well, I turned the page and saw the title of your poem, and I immediately flashed back 40 years to a mysterious quest that I was on, and I hadn't thought about it in years. I used to be involved with a lot of rock concert promotion, and I was a caterer. I was working for a caterer for a concert in Omaha by a group called Van Halen, and they'd given us a contract, and they said, we want the following items at the show. And it was this whole laundry list of stuff, like a lot of liquor, a lot of beer, a lot of wine, food, etc. They also wanted an inflatable doll. And there was another thing on the list that we looked at, and my co-caterer, neither one of us knew what this thing was. We looked at it and we said, what is this? So we went around. First of all, we were trying to find an inflatable doll. Now, that wasn't very easy in Des Moines. We had to go to these triple X bookstores, and finally we went in one, and there was this lady, older lady in there, smoking a cigarette, and she's got that smoker's voice, that sort of raspy voice, and we decided, well, we're going to ask her, because she has the inflatable doll, we're going to ask her about this other item and see if she knows what it is, and we said, we're looking for 24 Coney Island whitefish. And she laughed like you're laughing, and she just, oh, and she told us what they were. And we were just like, huh? We had never heard the term before. And then I open your book, and here's a poem called Coney Island Whitefish.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She says, that's the only fish you ever see wash up on Coney Island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's where poetry comes from. Lots of times there will be some strange phrase that sticks in your mind. And I remember when I lived on the East Coast, I heard people talk occasionally about Coney Island whitefish. For the listeners who don't know what we're talking about, a used prophylactic that's thrown in the water is often referred to by New Yorkers anyway. And on the East Coast, it's referred to as a Coney Island whitefish. And actually, you want me to read that poem?
If you want, sure.
Sure.
Okay.
I'll read that.
All right.
And here it is, Coney Island whitefish. A sticker on the dispenser in the truck stop men's room warns that abstinence and monogamy are the only safe roads, but condoms hitch a ride wherever they can. New Yorkers call used rubbers floating in the Atlantic Coney Island whitefish, and the foil wrappers they come in turn up on beaches everywhere in swirled indentations of sand. French letters, gloves of love, prophylactic sweat and squirm in wallets, wait patiently in purses, sleep in sock drawers and nightstands, always ready to hold back a life or save one. So what did you do? How did you find a Coney Island whitefish for this event?
Well, once the lady explained what they were, we went out and got them, and they were there. And we also had to remove all the brown M&Ms because that was in their contract.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's really a true story. Van Halen was that way. And I heard years later,
gosh.
The reason they did this was because they wanted to make sure that the people arranging these concerts read the contracts and read the details, because otherwise they thought maybe the stage wouldn't be safe. They were basically protecting themselves.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite a story.
Yeah.
That's quite a story.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite poems, and I think it's one that will really strike a chord with a lot of people, is your poem, Ronald Reagan's Aquarium.
Oh, yeah.
What a beautiful poem.
Thank you.
What came?
Actually came from a magazine article that I read about Ronald Reagan. It's a true story. I mean, virtually everything in the poem is true. I mean, I embellished details, but it's a true story about his battle with dementia.
Mm. That's a powerful poem.
Thanks.
Yeah.
You want me to read that one?
Sure.
Okay. Ronald Reagan's Aquarium. And this is a story about, a lot of my poems tell stories. A lot of them are narrative. And it's a poem about how Nancy Reagan found that her husband had reached into an aquarium and pulled out a little replica of the White House, and he was so deep in dementia he really didn't know what it was. So here goes. Ronald Reagan's Aquarium. Neon tetras, tiger barbs, and rainbow sharks swim round and round through seaweed and ferns, over moss and ornaments nestled in the coral and lava rock of the aquarium Nancy Reagan has placed in her husband's study. Deep in dementia, the former president watches from an armchair and fixates on a miniature resin replica of the White House. He rolls up a sleeve and lifts it out of the tank, rubbing with his fingers until the windows, doors, and columns are dry. When his wife checks on him, he hides the thing in his hands, embarrassed by his obsession. She wants to see what he's gripping so tightly, has to pull it away from him. "Do you know what this is?" she asks. "No," he answers, his face reddening. "But it has something to do with me."
Hmm.
Yeah.
Powerful. Really makes you feel
it's,
something.
I was very moved by that story. I couldn't get it out of my head. And it's funny, poems for me take a long time to gestate. And I read that article, and it was probably 3 or 4 years later before I got it into a poem.
Hmm. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest today, David Lee Garrison. We're talking about his new collection of poetry. It's called Light in the River. And I'll continue my conversation with David right after this. My guest is David Lee Garrison. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling. We're talking about David's new collection, Light in the River. And I need to compliment you on this beautiful photo on the cover. Lovely.
Oh, thank you. And that has an interesting story, too. The photo was taken by a friend of mine that I've known since first grade. And he's a professor. His name is Kerry Ahern, and he's a professor at Oregon State. And he just sent me the photo one day out of the blue. He's a good photographer, and he sent me this picture. And until that time, I did not have any idea of what I was going to use for the cover. But when I saw that photo that he emailed me, and I said, "This is it.
Mm.
This is what I need for the cover." And I love it, too. I do think it's beautiful.
I'm going to guess that you're grouping under the title Willows. Are these poems about aging, about dealing with illness? How did you group them in that section?
Many of them are stories of other people. Some of them are my own story. I had cancer in 1997.
Oh.
And, you know, that really was a turning point in my life. I thankfully made a complete recovery, but the experience was harrowing, and I've written about that. The poem Willows is actually about an uncle of mine who died of lung cancer.
Okay. Yeah, there's a very deep personal feel to a lot of these poems in this section, like Overcoat.
Yeah, I'm glad you like that one. Yeah, that's a poem about my father, and I think the father-son relationship is always a complex one, and this was about him and some of the things that where we connected and some of the ways in which we didn't connect, and yeah.
Mm.
So I could read that one if you like.
If you'd like to read that, or I kind of like to hear you read The End Is Near, actually.
Okay. We'll go back to the first section, and I'm going to read The End Is Near.
Yeah.
And this has an Ohio connection in it. I'm sure many listeners remember this, but there was a giant bust of Jesus that you would go by between Dayton and Cincinnati on I-75. And I thought it was ironic that it was struck by lightning and destroyed. I'm not sure what that means, but
yeah.
I put it in the poem. The end is near. Jesus is everywhere on the highway, his rusty blue cross placed between two yellow ones or wreathed in plastic flowers, draped in banners bearing names. The skeletal remains of a bust of the Savior, destroyed a few months back by lightning, teeter in the wind. Trust Jesus in black spray paint, and Jesus saves in white block letters above the throb of traffic. Radio preachers spread fear of the Lord far and wide. Suddenly, red taillights flash ahead of me. I slam on the brakes and whisper his name.
You really work on the endings, don't you?
You know, to me, the ending of a poem is important. The beginning is important, but I think you have to end with the something that is memorable and that really gets to the reader.
Mm-hmm. In your poem, Mink, you're talking about a woman. Was this someone you knew? Someone, a family friend, perhaps?
Yes. It was a family friend, and her story always fascinated me. She, when she was a young woman, a man proposed to her. She had these parents that were very kind of domineering, and they didn't want her to, they wouldn't let go of her. And so they offered her as a bribe, they offered her a mink coat if she would turn this guy down. And she did, and she took the mink coat, and no man ever proposed to her again. And then she inherited quite a bit of money, and she began to feel like men were after her money. And so it was a sad story.
She sounds like a very unhappy person.
She was.
Yeah.
She was.
And so she never married?
She never married and actually died fairly young.
Uh-huh.
And lived a very reclusive life at the end. So, yes, it was an interesting but very sad story. I tend to write about people.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about Ronald Reagan and, other people that I've written about. I'm not so much a nature poet. A lot of people write about nature. That's not me. I like to write about people and their stories, people and their lives.
Well, if we just looked at the cover, we might think you were a nature poet.
Yes. Yeah, I never thought of that.
Yeah. Between the photo and the title.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, it's a beautiful collection. Do you want to choose a poem to read for us, or should I pick another one for you, or what?
You go ahead. I like this. I like hearing what you have been interested in.
Well, so, how about Mink? Do you want to read Mink?
All right. I'll read Mink.
All right.
Okay, Mink. Martha trailed behind her parents, who made a grand entrance at family gatherings, waving to everyone like politicians. Pushing 40, She was fading deep into their shadows. Her parents talked too much, but Martha rarely said a word. I wondered why she never married or brought a man around. There was a man, my mother told me, but her parents wouldn't let go of her. He proposed, and they begged her to turn him down, offered her a mink as a bribe. She took the coat, and no man asked again. After she inherited, Martha began to suspect the motives of men, even though she barely knew. She believed male interest sprang not from who she was, but what she had. She quit her accounting job and moved out to the lake. Her body hidden in shapeless dresses, Martha comes to our house at Christmas and hands my mother a bottle of French champagne. I help her off with her coat and hang it in the hall closet, sweeping several others aside to give it room to let it breathe. Poor Martha.
It's almost like a novella. It's like you've told this woman's life story in this flash fiction. Just boom. It's all there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it as flash fiction, but yes, that's a whole life story in one brief poem.
Uh-huh. Another one that struck me as being fairly autobiographical was The Blade Sharpener.
Yes, yes. I didn't mention it when you asked me about my career as a professor, but I taught Spanish and Portuguese, and Blade Sharpener is about being in Spain. And Spain, when I visited, when I went, I spent a year abroad there in 1965, and at that time, Spain still had not recovered from the Spanish Civil War in many ways, and it was still a very, very old country, and it had these old customs. And one of them was that there were men who made a living by driving around, and this is right in Madrid, driving around on a bicycle, and they had a whetstone that was moved by the pedals of the bike. And so they would drive around and make a living by sharpening knives and scissors. And what I thought was especially intriguing was all of these, what they were called in Spanish was afiladores, knife sharpeners. All of them are blade sharpeners. All of them had a little whistle that had about three or four notes, and it was so distinctive that no matter how much street noise there was, construction, whatever, you could hear that whistle. And the blade sharpener would drive around, and he would blow that little whistle, and women would, usually what would happen is the women would hear up in the kitchen, and they would send their children down with knives and scissors to be sharpened, and he would pedal his bike and sharpen the knives. But it was symbolic. This whole thing was symbolic of the how old Spain was.
Mm.
And when I returned later, after Franco was gone and the country had modernized quite a lot, I did run into one of them who was still around. There were a few that were still around, but basically the profession had died out.
Uh-huh. So it was a different one. It wasn't the same one you saw 20 years before.
I don't think so, but
yeah.
It certainly could have been.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know the guy by name, it basically was a knife sharpener, and I don't know that it was the same guy.
And that first time that you describe, the Generalissimo was still living. Spain was still mired in the past. But it must have been a really interesting place to be.
It was. I mean, I was so young that I didn't quite realize what I was seeing. But basically, I was seeing a 19th century country. For example, every building had a night watchman, and there wasn't so much of a police presence the way we have in the United States, but this night watchman, he did carry a nightstick, but he had the keys, and he didn't let you in or out of the building unless he knew you, and that was the way buildings were secured. And although it was I was living in a country that was a dictatorship, it was a very safe place. And that was one of the reasons.
My guest is David Lee Garrison. We've been talking about his new poetry collection, Light in the River. And you strike me as someone who probably is quite fond of a nice, ripe, homegrown tomato. Am I right?
I am. I love tomatoes. And okay. I make mention in one poem of a famous poem by Pablo Neruda called Ode to the Tomato, or Ode to Tomatoes. It's usually translated that way.
That's in For a Good Time that you make the reference.
Yes.
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 Yeah, that's a great ending. You really can hit the endings. You know, you remind me of a gymnast. You know, they have to like really stick it at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They have to make a good...
good landing.
A good landing,
uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
We probably have time for one more poem if you want to read For a Good Time. That'd be great.
Okay. We'll wind up with that. For a good time. For a good time, call Kathy, your friend from the old neighborhood, and have a long talk with her even though she's been gone for 10 years. Chat with your dog. Never mind that he doesn't answer. He knows you so well, you should be glad he can't speak. Sit behind the backstop of a Little League baseball game and stand up in a wave to cheer with the tiny crowd of parents and friends. Read Neruda's Ode to Tomatoes, then bite into a ripe one the way you would an apple, and let the juice and seeds burst onto your face like words.
David Lee Garrison reading from his new collection, Light in the River. And that poem has so many different elements. How long did it take to write that? And when did you write it? And how did you write it?
Okay. I wrote it fairly recently. I wrote it in the last year or so. And it was a lot of memories coming together. One is I have this kind of idea of people who have died, that they're still with us. I mean, I really am aware of that. And so I start out remembering someone, and her name really was Kathy, but she died fairly young. But I thought, yeah, I can talk to her. And then, let me see. I remember my brother told me that he used to go to his daughter's little softball games, and that there'd be maybe 25 people in the crowd, and they would do a wave the way they do at the baseball stadiums. It's kind of a soup of memories. I remembered reading this wonderful poem by Neruda. Neruda changed poetry in many ways because he has these odes to, they're called odas elementales, elementary odes, and he writes to things that are ordinary. Mm-hmm. And one of the more famous ones is Ode to Tomatoes, but he has an ode to clothing. He has an ode to the lemon. He has odes to things that we kind of take for granted and don't really see. Mm-hmm. And, his Ode to Tomatoes is just, it brings, it lets you see a tomato. In a way that you've never really seen before.
Mm. When you talk about the presence of the dead, are you a person who dreams about people who are no longer with us? They're still with us, though, in your dreams?
I do, but uh-huh. I think a lot of people do. Uh-huh. But I think people who have died are... they're in our dreams. They're also, I think, they're so in our memories. I mean, sometimes something will happen and it will remind you of a person that you've lost. Mm. And as you get older, I'm 75 now, as you get older, more and more of your friends and relatives are gone. And so what you have are your memories of them.
Mm. Yeah, I find that that's true as I get older and I start having dreams about people that there's like just a fluid membrane there. Like you'll be in a dream and there's a person that you know is dead and another person that is alive. And just the other night I had a dream about a friend of mine whose wife died a year or two ago and they were there together in the dream. And it was very clear. We both were aware that, yes, she is dead. And I said to him, you know, she looks like she's doing really well. And he goes, yeah. He says, it's really amazing. She's doing great.
Yeah.
I was like, okay.
I connect with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, wow. Okay. Well, now we're getting into the deep philosophical underpinnings of poetry. My guest has been David Lee Garrison. And it's been so nice talking to you about your collection, Light in the River. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure talking with you, Vic. And I really appreciate your take on the book. It's really been interesting to see how you responded to it.
All righty. It's just out, published by, is it Dos Madres?
Dos Madres Press in Cincinnati.
Okay.
Yes.
All righty. David Lee Garrison, if you're looking for the name, Light in the River. Thanks again, David.
Thank you.
And that was David Lee Garrison, talking about his new poetry collection. It's called Light in the River. And David spoke to me on the telephone from Kansas, but as many of you probably know, he lives in Oakwood, longtime Daytonian, former professor, many years at Wright State teaching Spanish and Portuguese. And his new collection, really some great poetry in there. And if you didn't catch it, he's one of our curators for the Conrad's Corner poetry segments you hear on the radio station. David alternates every other month and picks out the poetry that you hear on that program. We've got some extra time left on the show today. We're going to bring you a Book Nook bonus segment, a Book Nook flashback right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. Do you remember the year 2003? Do you remember anything significant about it? Well, for many Daytonians, 2003 was the century celebration of the invention of flight by our very own Wright brothers. And lots of books came out in 2003 about that accomplishment by the Wright brothers. And I spoke to a number of authors about their Wright brother books during 2003, and one of them was a gentleman with connections to our region. He's originally from Clark County. At the time I talked to him in 2003, Tom Crouch was the senior curator at the Smithsonian Institute National Air and Space Museum, and he had just been the co-author of a book called The Wright Brothers and the Invention of the Aerial Age. Here's Tom Crouch for the best of the Book Nook.
Let's talk about the Wright brothers and how their ability to think almost with one mind helped them to solve a lot of problems that made it possible for them to fly.
Yeah, the fact that there were two of them, and not only two of them, but two brothers, and not only two brothers, but two brothers who were extraordinarily close. They came from a family, one of those 19th century fortress families, sort of writ large. Their father, who was a church bishop, had really taught his children that the world beyond the family doorstep was a pretty dangerous place, and ultimately there were temptations out there. People would try to lure you off the path of virtue. Friends would desert you in times of trial, and ultimately what you could depend on was your family. And having grown up in a family like that, they were just very, very close. And they knew one another very well. They knew one another's strengths and weaknesses, and how to play to those. They knew one another well enough so that they knew there was no danger of sort of fatally offending the other one, which meant that they could argue right down to the ground. People who knew them and who listened to them doing this, you know, were often afraid they were going to come to blows. Charlie Taylor, who was their machinist in the bike shop, used to talk about that. But in fact, it was just their way of arguing through a problem. They used to joke, saying that they would argue so hard that the person who was on one side of an argument at the beginning would be on the other side at the end, and vice versa.
And purely as a speculation, were it not for the horrific injury that Wilbur suffered playing shinny, do you think they ever would have done what they did?
You know, to understand what the Wright brothers did and why they did it, you really do have to understand sort of the psychology of the Wright brothers. Not that you want to psychoanalyze them or anything, but you sort of have to try to get a handle on what motivated them. And as you suggest, when Wilbur was 18, playing sort of a game of pickup hockey called shinny on the frozen pond that's still at the foot of the soldiers' home in West Dayton, one of his opponent's sticks got out of his hand and hit Wilbur right in the face. And it's tough to tell how much physical damage it really did. His father, Bishop Wright, says that that injury led to what he refers to as heart palpitations. And the upshot was that Wilbur sort of became an invalid for a period of time. And his mother was dying of tuberculosis. And as he began to sort of come out of his funk, he took it upon himself to take care of his mother. His father was always on the road with church business. His brother Orville and his sister Kate were younger than he was. So he sort of saw it as his task to take care of his dying mother. And he did. And by the time he was through that period, I think he really had the feeling that life had sort of passed him by somehow. By 1896, 1899, he was still living in his father's house. He was in his early 30s. He was running two small businesses, really small businesses, with his brother. And I think he looked around and, again, thought that life was kind of passing him by. And he was really, truly looking for a challenge, something against which to measure himself. He felt within himself all of these talents and capabilities, and he was looking for a way to demonstrate them to the world, and he found it in the airplane.
So is this about the time that he wrote a letter to, where did he send that letter? It's in 1899, I believe. He sent it to some place in Washington. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. He sent it to the Smithsonian Institution. Samuel Langley, because of those small powered aerodrome flights that I mentioned, was much in the news as a leader of world aviation. And he was the head of the Smithsonian. So the Wrights, in May of 1899, sent a very famous letter to the Smithsonian. Wilbur sent it, and he sort of tried to explain his interest in flight in a humorous way to indicate to the folks at the Smithsonian that he was not a crank, but serious about this thing. And he asked for information on what other people had done in flying machine studies over the years. And the Smithsonian sent him a nice-sized package of free publications and a list of other things that they could buy if they wanted. And that was their starting point. That letter is the first time they admitted to anybody that the Wright brothers, were interested in flight.
We hear about the preservation of these early inventions, and it's really amazing to read in your book that the Wrights, when they were done with something, they really didn't care too much. They left it laying out in the elements. It's a miracle that they had anything survive from that first flight. The Dayton flood almost took care of that.
Mm-hmm. It really is amazing that two pioneer airplanes from that era survive, because the great gliders that had been the 1900, 1901, 1902 glider that had been the Wright brothers' stepping stones to powered flight, and just incredibly important, as you suggest, they left to rot in the sand when they came back to Dayton from Kitty Hawk. The 1903 airplane, the one that we're celebrating this year, was the only one they ever consciously saved. It was badly destroyed by a wind gust when it was sitting on the ground after their fourth flight. And they dutifully picked up the sad remains, boxed them up, and sent them home to Dayton. And as you suggest, they actually didn't open the crates again. The crates with the world's first airplane went through the Dayton flood, 10 feet underwater in the 1913 flood. And it was really only after that, Wilbur was dead now, that Orville decided, well, gosh, maybe I'd better open the old crates and see what's left. And in fact, he wound up putting the world's first airplane back together again for the first time in 1916. And worked on it some more in 1928 before he put it on long-term loan to the Science Museum of London during his feud with the Smithsonian over claims they had made about the capability of the old Langley machine to fly. So that machine, the 1903 machine, which is the centerpiece of the National Air and Space Museum today, was the only one they consciously saved. The other great Wright airplane that survives, of course, is their third airplane, which they flew at Huffman Prairie here in the Miami Valley in 1905. And it was the airplane that, any way you really want to cut it, was the world's first practical airplane. In 1903, their best flight had been 852 feet and 59 seconds. You know, it wasn't going to cut your time to the coast by very much. And they knew that. And so they had come home to Dayton and continued to fly as quietly as they could in 1904 and 1905. And by the fall of 1905, they could stay up as long as they wanted to. They were flying 25 miles worth of circles over that little cow pasture in Bath Township, Greene County. And, I mean, they could have stayed up as long as the gas and oil held out. So that was really the world's first practical airplane. And it was saved only by an accident of history. They had left it to rot in the sand like their gliders. And somebody who was interested in the Wright brothers' history a few years later wrote to Orville and said, you know, I'd like a Wright airplane to put in the museum I'm planning. And Orville originally wrote him and said, well, don't have anything. And then he wrote back and said, you know, when we were at Kitty Hawk in 1911, I noticed that the parts of the old 1905 machine, which they had taken back to Kitty Hawk to test fly before they went public in 1908, I noticed that those remains were still sticking out of the sand. And I'll bet if you sent a few bucks to the life-saving station guys, they dig them out and send them to you. And those parts are the core of that historic airplane that's in Carillon Park today.
Isn't that amazing?
It's a good story.
Yeah. And we have a situation here. You referred to it again, the controversy with the Smithsonian. The big villain in this is Glenn Curtis, isn't he? Isn't he kind of a villain? I mean, he was trying to weasel out of the patent infringement thing. He flew the Langley plane. He reconstructed it and radically changed it.
He did.
And then he got the Smithsonian to make statements, which Orville really had a problem with. That's why he sent that plane to England.
Exactly. Again, in 1914, the Wrights, at that point, the Wright patent suit against Glenn Curtis had been going on for 5 years. And every time the courts had handed down a decision, it was in favor of the Wright brothers. And Curtis was running out of loopholes to keep the case alive. And so he came up with the notion of borrowing the sad remains of the old Langley machine, which was really about destroyed in the crash in December of 1903, and rebuilding it and flying it near Hammondsport, where his factory was. And he did that. He made a great many changes in the aerodrome and flew it and then tried to go back to court and say, you see, Judge, Langley was capable of flying before the Wright brothers, and I proved it, so you shouldn't give their patent so much latitude. The courts threw that out immediately, recognizing how many changes Curtis had made. But the secretary of the Smithsonian at that time, Secretary Charles Walcott, who was an old friend of Langley's, saw it as his obligation to sort of defend his old friend Langley, who had died in 1906. And so Walcott took up the cry and began describing the old Langley aerodrome as the first capable of flight. And you're right, it sent Orville right through the overhead.
Hmm. And Orville eventually was vindicated. He was a smart businessman, and he also was a good silent negotiator. He spoke louder with gestures than he did with words. And Glenn Curtis, I get the impression that he had two main interests. One went back to his days as a motorcycle racer. He liked to go fast. And the other interest was financial. Didn't he become a big real estate speculator after he stopped being involved with airplanes?
Yeah, like Orville sold the Wright Company in 1915. Curtis was forced out of his company after the First World War. And at that point, yeah, he became a real estate speculator in Florida. You know, Glenn Curtis is not an evil guy. Sure, he wanted to make money building and selling airplanes, as the Wright brothers did. And he didn't regard the patent situation as fair. I mean, it was fair, I think. The Wright brothers were playing by the rules, and they had him over a barrel, and they knew it. And Glenn Curtis was trying to squirm out of that. I mean, he was a guy who wanted to build airplanes and build better airplanes and push the technology. The ironic thing about the era of the patent suits is that when it was over in 1917, when the government finally helped end the era of the patent suits because World War I was coming and they saw it as potentially damaging, the Wright brothers had been out of the airplane business for 2 years at that point. Orville had sold the company in 1915 and just sort of walked away from the whole thing. Glenn Curtis, in 1917, when the patent suits were resolved, is the only American airplane builder who's operating at a European level. He's the only guy who's selling flying boats to the European warring powers, and he's selling his famous trainers, his JN4D Jennies, to the U.S. government, to the Canadians. And so he did succeed in pushing the boundaries of the envelope. He's a really interesting guy. And, I think the Wrights are correct in terms of the patent suit. It's also true that Glenn Curtis is the guy who continues trying to do better, trying to build better airplanes. Fascinating guy.
And that was our Book Nook bonus segment going back to 2003. My interview with Tom Crouch talking about his book, The Wright Brothers and the Invention of the Aerial Age. At the time, Tom was the senior curator at the Smithsonian Institute National Air and Space Museum. And in 2003, many books came out about the Wright brothers. It was the 100th anniversary of that historic first powered flight with Orville on board that aeroplane in December of 1903. And some of you who listen to the program on a regular basis might recall that 5 years ago, I had a guest named Harry Haskell. His grandfather had married the Wright brothers' sister, Catherine, late in her life. They were only together for about 3 years before she died, and Orville was brokenhearted about it. In fact, after she announced her plans to marry, he didn't speak to her. He ignored her until she was on her deathbed. Well, Patty Dan has imagined what that was like to be the Wright sister in that situation. She's written a novel about it. It's called The Wright Sister. And I spoke to her about it this week. Tune in tomorrow morning at 10:30 as we bring you Patty Dan and the Wright Sister. And it's quite a book. She imagines Catherine Wright's thoughts and what she might have written in a letter to Orville. And that's coming up tomorrow at 10:30. I'll be talking to Patty Dan about the Wright sister right here. We call it the Book Nook.